Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Second quarter of Part 1. Divine Right of Kings. Before I go any further, let me take notice of some cheap tricks that the abettors of election, as the only lawful title to the crown, are ready to use so as to make the support of the just principles of our constitution a dislikable task. When you defend the inheritable nature of the crown, these tricksters present you as supporting a fictitious cause and fictional people. They commonly argue as if they were in a conflict with some of those exploded fanatics of slavery, who used to maintain what I believe no one now maintains, namely, that the crown is held by divine hereditary and indefeasible right. These old fanatics of single arbitrary power, dogmatized as if hereditary royalty was the only lawful government in the world, just as our new fanatics of popular arbitrary power maintain that popular election is the sole lawful source of authority, the old divine right extremists did indeed speculate foolishly, and perhaps impiously too, implying that monarchy has more of a divine sanction than any other mode of government, and that a right to govern by inheritance is strictly indefeasible in all circumstances for any person who was in the line of succession to a throne. But an absurd opinion concerning the king's hereditary right to the crown doesn't prejudice one that is rational and based on solid principles of law and policy. If all the absurd theories of lawyers and divines were to destroy the things they are talking about, we would have no law and no religion left in the world. An absurd theory on one side of a question doesn't justify telling untruths or promulgating mischievous maxims on the other. The second claimed right, to dismiss kings for misconduct. Of the three claims of the Revolution Society that I mentioned earlier, the second is a right of dismissing their governors for misconduct. If the declaration of the Act implying the abdication of James II had any fault, is that it was rather too guarded and too clotted with detail, and this may have been because those ancestors of ours were anxious not to form such a precedent as that of dismissing for misconduct. But all this guardedness and all this accumulation of circumstances serves to show the spirit of caution that predominated in the national councils in a situation where men irritated by oppression and elevated by a triumph over it might have abandoned themselves to violent and extreme courses of action. It shows, regarding the great men who influenced the conduct of affairs at that great event, how anxious they were to make the revolution a parent of settlement and not a nursery of future revolutions. No government could stand for a moment if it could be blown down by anything as loose and indefinite as an opinion of misconduct. Those who led at the Revolution based the virtual abdication of King James on no such light and uncertain principle. They charged him with nothing less than a design, confirmed by many open illegal acts, to subvert the Protestant Church and State and their fundamental, unquestionable laws and liberties. They charged him with having broken the original contract between king and people. This was more than misconduct. A grave and overruling necessity obliged them to take the step they took, and took with infinite reluctance, under that most rigorous of all laws, the original contract between king and people. They didn't rely on future revolutions for the future preservation of the constitution. The grand policy of all their regulations was to make it almost impracticable for any future sovereign to compel the states of the kingdom to have recourse again to those violent remedies. they left the crown in the condition of being completely exempt from legal responsibility, which is what it had always been in the eye and estimation of law. In order to lighten the crown still further, they added responsibility to ministers of state. By the statute called the Act for Declaring the Rights and Liberties of the Subject and for Settling the Succession of the Crown, they enacted that the ministers should serve the crown on the terms of that declaration. Then they secured frequent meetings of Parliament by which the whole government would be under the constant inspection and active control of the popular representative and of the magnates of the kingdom. In the next great constitutional act for further limiting the crown and better securing the rights and liberties of the subject, they provided that no impeachment by the Commons in Parliament should be undercut by a royal pardon. They thought that these three, the rule laid down for government in the Declaration of Right, the constant inspection of Parliament, and the practical claim of impeachment, would provide an infinitely better security for their constitutional liberty and against the vices of administration than could be provided by their claiming a right so difficult in the practice, so uncertain in outcome, and often so mischievous in the consequences, as that of dismissing their governors. Kings as Servants of the People. Dr. Price, in his sermon, very properly condemns the practice of gross, adulatory addresses to kings. Instead of this fulsome style, he proposes that on occasions of congratulation, His Majesty should be told that he is to consider himself as more properly the servant than the sovereign of his people. As a compliment, this new form of address doesn't seem to be very soothing. Those who are servants in name as well as in effect don't like to be told of their situation, their duty, and their obligations. It is not pleasant as compliment. It is not wholesome as instruction. After all, if the king were to adopt this language, and take the label Servant of the People, as his royal style, I can't imagine what good this would do us, or him. I have seen very proud letters signed, Your Most Obedient Humble Servant. The proudest denomination that ever was endured on earth, the Roman Catholic Church, took a title of still greater humility than the one now proposed for sovereigns by Price. Kings and nations were trodden down by the foot of one, the Pope, calling himself the Servant of Servants. I would have considered all this servant stuff as merely empty talk in which some people allow the spirit of liberty to evaporate, if it weren't plainly offered in support of the idea of dismissing kings for misconduct. In that light, it is worth some discussion. Kings are undoubtedly the servants of the people in one sense, because their power has no rational purpose except the general advantage. But, by our constitution at least, it isn't true that they are anything like servants in the ordinary sense of the word. The essence of a servant's situation is to obey the commands of someone else and to be removable at pleasure. But the King of Great Britain obeys no one else. All other persons are, individually and collectively, under him and owe him a legal obedience. The law, which doesn't know how to flatter or to insult, calls this high magistrate not our servant, as Price calls him, but our sovereign lord the king. We have only learned to speak this language of the law, and not the confused jargon of the revolutionary pulpits. Because he is not to obey us, and we are to obey the law in him, our constitution doesn't in any way make him, as a servant, in any degree responsible. Our constitution knows nothing of any legally appointed court, or legally settled process, for submitting the king to the responsibility that all servants have. In this he is not distinguished from the commons and the lords, who in their various public capacities can never be called to account for their conduct. Yet the Revolution Society chooses to assert, in direct opposition to one of the wisest and most beautiful parts of our constitution, that, A king is no more than the first servant of the public, created by it and responsible to it. Our ancestors at the 1688 revolution wouldn't have deserved their fame for wisdom if they had found no security for their freedom, except making their government feeble in its operations and precarious in its tenure, if they couldn't devise any better remedy against arbitrary power than civil confusion. The ceremony of dismissing kings, which these gentlemen talk about so casually, can seldom, if ever, be performed without force. It then becomes a case of war, and not of constitution. Laws are commanded to hold their tongues among arms, and tribunals fall to the ground with the peace they are no longer able to uphold. The revolution of 1688 was obtained by a just war, in the only way in which any war can be just. As Livy said, wars are just to those for whom they are necessary. The question of dethroning or dismissing kings always was, and always will be, an extraordinary question of state, and wholly out of the law. A question, like all other questions of state, of dispositions and means and probable consequences, rather than of positive rights. Not having been made as a cure for common abuses, it isn't to be thought about by common minds. The theoretical line of demarcation, where obedience should end and resistance begin, is faint, obscure, and not easily definable. It isn't determined by any single act or single event. Governments must be very abused and deranged before dismissal can be thought of, and the prospect of the future, if there is no dismissal, must be as bad as the experience of the past. When things are as bad as that, the nature of the disease will have to indicate the remedy to those who are qualified to administer this crucial, ambiguous, bitter medicine to a sick state. Times and occasions and provocations will teach their own lessons. The wise will determine from the gravity of the case, the irritable from awareness of oppression, the high-minded from disdain and indignation at abusive power in unworthy hands, the brave and bold from the love of honourable danger and a generous cause. But, with or without right, a revolution will be the very last resource of thoughtful, good people. The third claimed right, to form a government for ourselves. The third of the three rights claimed from the pulpit of Old Jewry Street is the right to form a government for ourselves. This gets as little support, whether through precedent or principle, from anything done at the 1688 revolution as each of their first two claims. The revolution was made to preserve our ancient, indisputable laws and liberties, and that ancient constitution of government which is our only security for law and liberty. If you want to know the spirit of our constitution, and the policy that predominated in that great period, and has secured it to this hour, please look for both in our histories, our records, our Acts of Parliament and Journals of Parliament, and not in the sermons of Old Jewry Street and the after-dinner toasts of the Revolution Society. In the sermons you will find other ideas and another language. The third right's claim is as ill-suited to our temperament and wishes as it is unsupported by any appearance of authority. The very idea of the making of a new government is enough to fill us with disgust and horror. At the time of the 1688 revolution, we wanted, as we still do, to derive all we possess as an inheritance from our forefathers. We have taken care not to graft onto that stock of inheritance any shoot that is alien to the nature of the original plant. All our reformations have proceeded on the principle of reverence for antiquity, and I hope, indeed, I am convinced, that any future reformations will be carefully formed on analogical precedent, authority, and example. Our liberties as an inheritance. Our oldest reformation is that of Magna Carta. You will see that Sir Edward Coke, that great oracle of our law, and indeed all the great men who follow him, work hard to prove the pedigree of our liberties. They try to prove that the Magna Carta of King John was connected with another positive charter from Henry the First, and that both of these were nothing more than a reaffirmation of the still more ancient standing law of the kingdom. On the matter of fact, these authors appear to be mostly in the right, though perhaps not always. But if the lawyers go wrong in some details, that proves my position still more strongly, because it demonstrates the powerful tendency to favour antiquity that has always filled the minds of all our lawyers and legislators, and of all the people they want to influence, and the unchanging policy of this kingdom in considering their most sacred rights and franchises as an inheritance. In the famous law of Charles the First's time, called the Petition of Right, the Parliament says to the King, "Your subjects have inherited this freedom," claiming their freedoms not on such abstract principles as the rights of men, but as the rights that Englishmen have inherited from their forefathers. Selden and the other profoundly learned men who drew up this Petition of Right were at least as well acquainted with all the general theories concerning the rights of men as any of the discoursers in our pulpits or on your tribune in Paris, as well as Dr. Price. But, for reasons worthy of the practical wisdom that superseded their theoretical science, they preferred this positive, recorded, hereditary title to everything that can be dear to the man and the citizen. The vague, theoretical right that exposed their secure inheritance to being scrambled for and torn to pieces by every wild and litigious spirit. The same policy pervades all the laws that have since been made for the preservation of our liberties. In the Declaration of Right, of the time of William and Mary, the two Houses of Parliament don't utter a syllable of a right to form a government for themselves. You will see that their whole care was to secure the religion, laws, and liberties that had been long possessed and recently endangered. Taking into their most serious consideration the best means for making an establishment that will not again put their religion, laws, and liberties in danger of being subverted, they ceremonially initiate all their proceedings by stating as some of those best means, in the first place, to do, as their ancestors in like cases have usually done, for vindicating their ancient rights and liberties by declaring, and then they pray the King and Queen, that it may be declared and enacted that all the rights and liberties asserted and declared are the true ancient and indubitable rights and liberties of the people of this kingdom. You will observe that from Magna Carta to the Declaration of Right, it has been the uniform policy of our Constitution to claim and assert our liberties as an inheritance that we have from our forefathers and are to transmit to our posterity, as an estate specially belonging to the people of this kingdom, with no reference to any other more general or prior right. By this means, our Constitution preserves its unity in the great diversity of its parts. This policy seems to come from profound reflection, or to be the happy effect of following nature, which is wisdom without reflection and above reflection. A spirit of innovation is generally the result of a selfish temperament and limited views. People who never look back to their ancestors will not look forward to posterity. Besides, the people of England know well that the idea of inheritance provides a sure principle of conservation and a sure principle of transmission, without at all excluding a principle of improvement. Whatever advantages are obtained by a state proceeding on these maxims are locked fast, as in a sort of family settlement, held tight for ever. By a constitutional policy that follows the pattern of nature, we receive, hold, and transmit our government and our privileges in the same way as we enjoy and transmit our property and our lives. The institutions of policy, the goods of fortune, and the gifts of providence are handed down to us and on from us in the same course and order. Our political system is placed in a sound correspondence and symmetry with the order of the world, and with the kind of existence possessed by a permanent body composed of transitory parts. God's stupendous wisdom moulds together the great mysterious body of the human race in such a way that the whole thing is never at one time old or middle-aged or young, but moves on unchangeably constant through the varied tenor of perpetual decay, fall, renovation, and progression. Thus, by preserving the method of nature and the conduct of the state, in what we improve we are never wholly new, in what we retain we are never wholly obsolete. By adhering to our forefathers in this way, and on those principles, we are guided not by the superstition of antiquarians, but by the spirit of philosophical analogy. In this choice of inheritance, we have given to our political structure the image of a blood relationship, binding up the constitution of our country with our dearest domestic ties, adopting our fundamental laws into the bosom of our family affections, keeping inseparable our state, our hearths, our sepulchres, and our altars. Through the same plan of conforming to nature in our artificial institutions, and by calling on the aid of nature's unerring and powerful instincts to strengthen the fallible and feeble contrivances of our reason, we have derived several other considerable benefits from seeing our liberties as an inheritance. The spirit of freedom, when left to itself, inclines towards misrule and excess. But when it acts as if in the presence of canonized forefathers, it is toned down by an awesome solemnity. This idea that our freedom is something that has come down to us inspires us with a sense of habitual native dignity, which prevents the upstart insolence that almost inevitably infects and disgraces those who acquire a distinction that they haven't inherited. By this means, our liberty becomes a noble freedom. It carries an imposing and majestic aspect. It has a pedigree and illustrious ancestors. It has its bearings and its coats of arms, its gallery of portraits, its monumental inscriptions, its records, evidences, and titles. All your logic choppers can't produce anything better adapted to preserve a rational and manly freedom than the course we have pursued, choosing our nature rather than our theories, our hearts rather than our inventions, as the great conservatories and storehouses of our rights and privileges. How France missed its opportunity. You could have profited from our example, and given to your recovered freedom a corresponding dignity. Your privileges, though they had been discontinued, were not lost to memory. It's true that while you were out of possession, your constitution suffered waste and dilapidation, but you possessed some of the walls and all the foundations of a noble and venerable castle. You could have repaired those walls and built on those old foundations. Your constitution was suspended before it was finished, but you had the elements of a constitution very nearly as good as could be wished. In your old states you possessed a variety of parts that matched the variety among the people of whom your community was happily composed. All that combination and all that opposition of interests, that action and counteraction which, in the natural world and the political one, draw out the harmony of the universe from the struggle among discordant powers. These opposed and conflicting interests, which you saw as such a great blemish in your old constitution and in our present one, call a healthy halt to all precipitate decisions. They make all change a subject of compromise, which naturally begets moderation. They produce temperaments that prevent the sore evil of harsh, crude, unqualified reformations, and make all the headlong exertions of arbitrary power, whether in the few or in the many, for ever impracticable. Through that diversity of members and interests, general liberty had as many securities as there were separate views in the various parts of society, while the separate parts would have been prevented from warping and jumping out of their allotted places by the downward pressure on them of a real monarchy. You had all these advantages in your ancient states, but you chose to act as if you had never been moulded into civil society, and had to begin everything anew. You began badly, by despising everything that belonged to you, setting up in trade without any capital. If the recent generations of your country struck you as not very distinguished, you could have passed them by and derived your claims from an earlier race of ancestors. Piously favouring those ancestors, your imaginations would have found in them a standard of virtue and wisdom beyond the vulgar practice of the present. And, setting them as the example you wanted to imitate, you would have risen. Respecting your forefathers, you would have learned to respect yourselves. You wouldn't have chosen to consider the French as a people of yesterday, as a nation of low-born, servile wretches, until the emancipating year of 1789. You would not have been content to be represented as a gang of runaway slaves, suddenly broken loose from the house of bondage, and therefore to be pardoned for your abuse of the liberty that you weren't accustomed to or well fitted for. Wouldn't it have been wiser, my worthy friend, to have people think, as I for one always have thought, that you are a generous and gallant nation, long misled to your disadvantage by your high and romantic sentiments of fidelity, honour, and loyalty, that events had been unfavourable to you, but that you were not enslaved to any anti-freedom or servile disposition, that in your most devoted submission you were actuated by a principle of public spirit, and that it was your country that you worshipped in the person of your king? If you had made people understand that, in the delusion of this amiable error, you had gone further than your wise ancestors, that you were resolved to resume your ancient privileges, while preserving the spirit of your ancient and your recent loyalty and honour, or if, unsure of yourselves, and not clearly seeing the almost obliterated constitution of your ancestors, you had looked to your neighbours in England, who had kept alive the ancient principles and models of the old common law of Europe, improved and adapted to its present state. Either way, by following wise examples, you would have given new examples of wisdom to the world. You would have made the cause of liberty venerable in the eyes of every worthy mind in every nation, shamed despotism from the earth by showing that freedom is not only reconcilable with law, but helpful to law, had an unoppressive but productive revenue, had a flourishing commerce to feed it, had a free constitution, a potent monarchy, a disciplined army, a reformed and venerated clergy, a friendlier but spirited nobility to lead your virtue, not to oppress it, had a liberal order of commons to emulate and to recruit that nobility, had a protected, satisfied, hard-working, and obedient people, taught to seek and to recognise the happiness that is to be found by virtue in all conditions. I'm talking about the virtue that involves the true moral equality of mankind, and not that monstrous fiction which, by giving false ideas and vain expectations to men destined to travel in the obscure path of working life, serves only to intensify and embitter the real inequality that it never can remove. Civil life secures that inequality, which does as much to benefit those it must leave in a humble state as to those it raises to a condition more splendid, but not more happy. You had a smooth and easy career of happiness and glory laid open to you, beyond anything in the history of the world, but difficulty is good for man, as your example shows. The harm the French Revolution has done. Compute your gains. See what is achieved by those extravagant and presumptuous theories that have taught your leaders to despise all their predecessors, all their contemporaries, and even themselves, until the moment when they became truly despicable. By following those false lights, France has brought undisguised calamities, at a higher price than any nation has purchased the most unequivocal blessings. France has bought poverty by crime. France hasn't sacrificed her virtue to her interests, but abandoned her interests so that she might prostitute her virtue. All other nations have begun the structure of a new government, or the reform of an old one, by establishing originally, or by enforcing with greater exactness, some rites of religion. All other people have laid the foundations of civil freedom in stricter manners and a system of a more austere and vigorous morality. France, when she let loose the reins of regal authority, doubled the license of a ferocious dissoluteness in manners, and of an insolent irreligion in opinions and practice, and has extended through all levels of society, as though distributing some privilege or laying open some previously restricted benefit, all the corruptions that have usually been the disease of wealth and power. This is one of the new principles of equality in France. France, through the treachery of her leaders, has given support to the dark, suspicious maxims of tyrannical distrust, and taught kings to tremble. A sovereign will regard those who advise him to place unlimited confidence in his people as subverters of his throne, as traitors who aim to destroy him by leading his easy good nature to allow combinations of bold and faithless men to have a share in his power. This alone is an irreparable calamity to you and to mankind. Remember that your Parliament of Paris told your king that in calling the states together he had nothing to fear but the extravagant excess of their zeal in providing for the support of the throne. Such soothing declarations tend to lull authority to sleep, to encourage it to engage rashly in perilous adventures of untried policy, to neglect the provisions, preparations, and precautions which distinguish benevolence from idiocy, and are essential for the salutary effect of any abstract plan of government or of freedom. For lack of these, they have seen the medicine of the state go bad and become its poison. They have seen the French rebel against a mild and lawful monarch with more fury, outrage, and insult than ever any people has been known to raise against the most illegal usurper or the most bloody tyrant. They were resisting the king's concessions, revolting against the protection he gave them, their blows aimed at a hand holding out graces, favours, and immunities. This was unnatural. What followed is not. They have found their punishment in their success. Laws overturned, tribunals subverted, industry without vigour, commerce expiring, taxes unpaid, yet the people impoverished, a church pillaged, and a state not relieved, civil and military anarchy made the constitution of the kingdom, everything human and divine sacrificed to the idol of public credit, with national bankruptcy as the consequence. And, to crown everything, the paper securities of new, precarious, tottering power, the discredited paper securities of impoverished fraud and beggared robbery, held out as a currency for the support of an empire in place of the two great recognized species that represent the lasting conventional credit of mankind. These two, silver and gold, disappeared and hid themselves in the earth from which they came. When the principle of ownership, which they create and represent, was systematically subverted. Were all these dreadful things necessary? Were they the inevitable results of the desperate struggle of determined patriots, compelled to wade through blood and tumult to the quiet shore of a quiet and prosperous liberty? No, nothing like it. The fresh ruins of France are not the devastation of civil war. They are the sad but instructive monuments of rash and ignorant thinking in a time of profound peace. The persons who have brought this about have met with little or no opposition in their progress. Their whole march was more like a triumphal procession than the progress of a war. their road-makers have gone ahead of them, and demolished and laid everything level at their feet. Not one drop of their own blood have they shed in the cause of the country they have ruined. They have made no sacrifices of greater consequence than their shoe-buckles, while they were imprisoning their king, murdering their fellow-citizens, and bathing in tears and plunging in poverty and distress thousands of worthy men and worthy families. Their cruelty has not even been the morally low result of fear. It has been the effect of their sense of perfect safety in authorizing treasons, robberies, rapes, assassinations, slaughters, and burnings throughout their harassed land. But the cause of it all was plain from the beginning. This unforced choice of evil would seem inexplicable if we didn't consider the composition of the National Assembly. I don't mean its formal constitution, which as it now stands is bad enough, but the materials of which it is mostly composed, this being vastly more important than the formalities. If we knew nothing of this assembly but its title and function, no colours could paint to the imagination anything more venerable. In that light, the mind of an inquirer, subdued by such an awe-inspiring image as that of the virtue and wisdom of a whole people brought together into a focus, would pause and hesitate to condemn even the things that looked worst. Instead of being blameworthy, they would appear only to be mysterious. But the men who compose any system of authority are what they have been made to be by God, nature, education, and their habits of life, and no name, no power, no function, no artificial institution whatsoever can turn them into something else. The people don't have the power to give their representatives any capacities but these. Virtue and wisdom may be the objects of the people's choice, but their choice doesn't confer either virtue or wisdom on those upon whom they lay their ordaining hands. They do not have the engagement of nature or the promise of revelation for any such powers. End of the second quarter of part 1.